Welcome back to the second half of the Making Waves show. As always, just like any radio station, the views expressed are not necessarily those of WSCA or its underwriters or its board. If you would like to send feedback about what you've heard on the show, questions, comments, complaints, observations, please send an email to nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com. And now we're going to hear a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal, U.S. political prisoner.
What kind of democracy is this? We live under the reign of almost universal political contempt. It doesn't matter which party, politicians are in the employ of others. And that isn't remotely those who voted for them, but rather those who could afford to finance them. They don't come out and say it often. But look at how politicians treat those who claim to be their constituents. The only common denominator is betrayal. Former President Bill Clinton perfected this to a high art. Virtually everybody who voted for him got betrayed sooner or later. And the real deal is, it isn't personal. That's the way the system was designed and has developed. To many of the men who we are accustomed to call the founding fathers, the word democracy was a bad word. They hated, dreaded, and feared the very idea of a democracy. New York's delegate to the Constitutional Convention of 1789, Alexander Hamilton, admired monarchy and sought ways to check what he called the amazing violence and turbulence of the democratic spirit. Historian Brian Price put it neatly at a lecture at Evergreen College in Olympia, Washington, when he asked, "Is it possible for a class which exterminates the native peoples of the Americas, replaces them by raping Africa for humans, it then denigrates and dehumanizes as slaves, while cheapening and degrading its own working class, is it possible for such a class to create democracy, equality, and to advance the cause of human freedom?" It took centuries of struggles by Africans, workers, women, and others to begin to erect some semblance of democracy. But as in a pendulum, things swing from one end to another. Nothing stands still. When folks stop fighting, other interests fight on. In the present political structure, wealthy anti-democratic elements continue to wage war through the purchase or rental of politicians, who then use their positions to advance the economic interests of their benefactors. That's how quietly, almost invisibly, through both Democrats and Republicans, the silent march of globalism has come to almost dominate all areas of our lives. The WTO, the IMF, and other international PACs eat out the hearts of local communities by supporting the efforts of international trade while carving out spaces where little vestiges of democracy once reigned. And war, because it is used by states to mobilize people in ways they wouldn't accept otherwise, is but an instrument in this global trade war. I mean, seriously, come on. Does anybody really believe that the Iraq War is to bring democracy? The great socialist leader Emma Goldman, at her anti-war trial for opposing World War I, said, "Verily, poor as we are in democracy, how can we give of it to the world? And even if we accept the present political structure, how can we reconcile this system of winner-take-all with any idea of democracy? Even in the parliaments of Europe, in England, of France, or Germany, minority parties receive representation in proportion to their voting strength. Here, 51% of the votes means 100% of the power. The 49%? Nothing. We don't really believe in democracy in America, nor have we ever done so. America stands for domination, period. It is domination that is being exported to the Middle East, just as it was exported 100 years ago to Indian country, to Oklahoma, and to Mexican territories. Democracy was a bad word then. It's a bad word now, used only as a mask for something else. How else, in the name of democracy, could we be so dominated, so controlled, so acquiescent? How else could we be so powerless in the face of ever-growing repression?" From Death Row, for Free Speech Radio News, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries were produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
We hope you had a happy Buy Nothing Day yesterday. If you don't know about Buy Nothing Day, Prepare for next year's by visiting www.adbusters.org. Here's a song by Jay Unger and Molly Mason as we enter the holiday buying season.
Things are crazy in this country of ours. Everybody's selling something, from diet pills to cars, all guaranteed to make us happier than we are. But I ain't gonna buy it. We used to be the land of the free. Now we're the land of 700 channels on TV, and on each one's a commercial aimed at me. But I ain't gonna buy it. I'm tired of people trying to sell me stuff. Don't they know that I've already got enough? No matter how you flaunt it, I'm never gonna want it. So I ain't gonna buy it. About all the things I'm missing, all the things I really need. Well, it's just one great big load of corporate greed. And I ain't gonna buy it. We've all heard that it pays to advertise. Even if those ads are all a pack of lies, it took me many years, but I got wise. And I ain't gonna buy it. I'm tired of people trying to sell me stuff. Don't they know that I've already got enough? My bank account is low, my closet's full and so I ain't gonna buy it.
You know, marketing used to be something that everybody did. They took a basket and went to the store and got what they needed. Now, it's a multi-billion dollar industry, just about the only one this country has left. And consumption used to be a disease. It still is.
Next time you find yourself at the mall, at a great big sale for Christmas, or summer, spring, or fall, just remember, you've already got it all. And say, I ain't gonna buy it. And now they're trying to sell me a war, one that's quick and clean and safe, as long as you're not brown or poor. But I can't quite figure out just what it's for. So I ain't gonna buy it. And I'm tired of politicians talking tough. Don't they know that I've already heard enough? No matter how they spin it, I don't trust it for a minute. And I ain't gonna buy it. I'm sick of all this selling, and brother, hear me yelling. I ain't gonna buy it.
Now for some announcements of upcoming local events. Tomorrow, Sunday, November 28th, Seacoast Peace Response will be participating in the Dover Holiday Parade. People are needed to march with the contingent. People will form up around noonish along 6th Street and the intersection of Central Ave. The parade doesn't start until about 3. For more information about this, please contact Wes Flair. His phone number is 335-6240, and his email is wesflierl1@netzero.net. On Monday, November 29th, please join members of Seacoast Peace Response for a vigil of solidarity with the Palestinian people. This will happen at Market Square in Portsmouth, beginning at 12:30 p.m. and going for approximately an hour. November 29th is an international day declared by the UN for Palestinian rights. Can you stop for a sec? The day commemorates the anniversary of the adoption of the 1947 UN Partition Plan for Palestine. For more information, please contact Vivian at 743-3774 or Vivian Cool 2, VivianCool 2, at webtv.net. The next day, we have a busy week coming up, there'll be a community forum sponsored by the Seacoast Alliance for Democracy and Seacoast Peace Response, also in Portsmouth, at the UU Church, 292 State Street. This is Tuesday night at 7 p.m. You're invited to come to speak and listen about the elections, Iraq, and the future of our democracy. Please come and participate in this. You might notice we haven't had election news this particular program, but that is not because there isn't still a lot of information and questions and need for people to speak out and learn more about it. Please come on Tuesday to do so. Can you stop? Later in the week, Friday night, December 3rd, after the peace vigil that happens in Market Square, the planning meeting of Seacoast Peace Response will take place at the Carnan House at 206 Court Street, which is behind the Unitarian Church in Portsmouth. And the following day, Saturday, December 4th, from 10 to 2, Left Out will meet at New England College in Henniker. The main item on the agenda will be their project for getting Democracy Now! Onto New Hampshire Public Radio. For more info about that, call George at 446-3561. We also have a number of days and anniversaries to remember and celebrate or commemorate for yourself this coming week. On December 1st, December 1st is World AIDS Day, also known as the Day Without Art. Also on December 1st, in 1955, Rosa Parks was arrested in Montgomery, Alabama for refusing to give her seat to a white man. A year-long successful boycott of buses in Montgomery followed her action. December 2nd is the International Day for the Abolition of Slavery. This date was adopted in 1949, amazingly, not very long ago. And then on December 3rd, in 1984, Union Carbide Chemical Plant exploded in Bhopal, India, resulting in thousands of deaths. The rest of our program is going to be dedicated to exploring Native American issues. Let's start this off with a song by a group called Eulali, which is a First Nations women's a cappella trio. Between the three, they represent Yakai, Apache, Mayan, and Tuscarora tribes.
Makchitamui kanspewa evi mampewa khokahinong dahontani gaitai iweme itai nankaya yamuni ewajitse
Magchita mui ang pigidi, magchita mui kanspewa ebi mampiwa, chokayinong dahon dani kaitai, iwe meitai, nangkaya yamumi ewajitse, nangkaya yamumi ewajitse.
Next, we're going to listen to a song by Joy Harjo called For Anime Pictou Aquash. First, we're going to learn a little bit about Anime Aquash for those of you who don't know her amazing story. From the era of Native American political activism and militancy during the early 1970s, there is no more haunting figure than Anime Pictou Aquash. An active American Indian Movement, AIM, member, as well as a mother, wife, social worker, and daycare teacher, her image is powerful as much for her untimely death as for her life's work. Born on March 27, 1945, to Mi'kmaq parents, Anna May grew up on Canadian Mi'kmaq reserves amid much poverty. However, her stepfather taught her and her siblings about the richness of her people's culture. She began attending an off-reserve school where she faced extreme racism. She remained in school, however, until her mother left her and her siblings. At that point, Anna May began working the potato and berry harvests. At 17, she moved to Boston with Mi'kmaq Jake Maloney and began factory work. Over the next few years, she gave birth to two daughters. In 1968, Natives were calling for equal rights, cultural recognition, and the fulfillment of promises made in treaties. Aquash worked as a volunteer in the Boston Indian Council's headquarters while holding down her factory job. Her council work centered on helping young urban Natives develop self-esteem, a technique that seemed to help them avoid alcohol abuse. At the Indian Council, Aquash heard about a planned protest by AIM. A number of New England AIM members were joining with national leader Russell Means to protest the official version of Thanksgiving. The traditional story behind Thanksgiving was that the pilgrims were greeted by and shared a feast with welcoming Indians. This version, of course, neglected to mention the legacy of conquest and slaughter that Europeans brought to the New World. Aquash participated in the protest, and the event made her even more determined to work for Native rights. Aquash, along with her daughters, moved to Bar Harbor, Maine, to work in the Teaching and Research in Bicultural Education School project. The girls attended the school and Pictou taught. The curriculum there consisted of traditional subjects as well as Indian history, values, and beliefs to foster pride in the students. Although the project was successful, it closed in 1972 when funding was cut. The family returned to Boston, where Aquash enrolled in the New Careers Program at Willow College. This program included both classroom instruction and community work. Pictou's assignment was teaching at a daycare center in Roxbury, a predominantly African-American section of Boston. She excelled in the program and in her work and was eventually offered a scholarship to attend Brandeis University in Massachusetts. Aquash declined the offer, preferring to continue her work in the Black and Indian communities. Around this time, she met and began a relationship with Nogishik Aquash, a Chippewa artist from Ontario. Together, they raised her daughters and became more involved in the growing Indian rights movement. In 1972, the couple participated in the march on Washington, D.C., called Trail of Broken Treaties. Originating with AIM, the march included Indians from all over the country who converged on the capital to draw attention to Indian issues. The group took over and occupied the Bureau of Indian Affairs building and then presented a list of 20 civil rights demands. After a week of occupation, the government promised to review their demands point by point, a great victory in the first time a national organization of Indians had faced a confrontation as a united people. Several months later, in April of 1973, a group of 200 Indians, led by AIM, congregated at the site of the 1890 Wounded Knee Massacre, in which 500 Army soldiers opened fire on a group of Minneconjou ghost dancers, killing 300 men, women, and children. Wounded Knee, located near the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, was chosen as the place for protest because of its painful historical significance. AIM wished to draw attention to its efforts against the reputedly corrupt administration of tribal chairman of the Oglala Sioux, Richard Dick Wilson, who used beatings and intimidation to rule the reservation. After hostilities increased, the town was occupied by 2,000 Indians in a siege lasting 70 days. When word of the occupation and siege by federal troops reached Boston, Pictou and Nogishik left for South Dakota. The standoff at Wounded Knee ended with the indictment of AIM leaders Dennis Banks and Russell Means. The Aquashes returned to Boston, where they continued their work for the movement. Aquash was on her way to becoming a national AIM leader. In 1974, she moved to St. Paul, Minnesota to work in the AIM office. Within a year, she was involved in the Menominee Indian takeover of an abandoned Alexian Brothers Catholic monastery in protest of the termination of their federal Indian status. The conflict in Gresham, Wisconsin, ended peacefully, but from that time on, Aquash was constantly under FBI observation. During the summer of 1975, Aquash and AIM Security Chief Leonard Peltier attended an AIM conference in Farmington, New Mexico, to lend support to Navajo protests over mining in the Four Corners area. From there, they were called back to Pine Ridge to help with security for Lakota traditionalists and AIM supporters who were being attacked by Wilson's provisional police force. They camped on the property of the Jumping Bull family. On June 26, 1975, a fight broke out between two FBI agents and AIM members. Two agents and a young Indian were killed. AIM members scattered as an international manhunt began for the FBI agents' killers. Peltier was later arrested, charged, and convicted of the murders of the two agents. 3 months later, in September 1975, Aquash was arrested with several others during a raid on the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota. Fearing the worst, she jumped bail and went underground. In November, leaving the Port Madison Reservation in Washington State, federal agents began watching the vehicles in the AIM caravan. In Oregon, state troopers stopped the group, and Aquash was again arrested and extradited to South Dakota. There, the judge released her on bail. She fled again on November 24, 1975. On February 24, 1976, a Lakota rancher found Aquash's dead body while riding the perimeter of his property. Her body's deteriorated condition indicated that she had been dead for some time. The body was initially taken to the Pine Ridge Public Health Service for an autopsy. Cause of death was listed as exposure, and she was buried as a Jane Doe. Her hands were cut off and sent to FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. for identification, and a week later, Aquash was identified. When her family was informed, they called on AIM to help them secure a second autopsy. On March 11, 1976, another postmortem revealed a .32 caliber bullet hole at the base of Anna Mae's skull. Her death was then officially designated a homicide. Aquash was reburied with traditional rites, and the investigation of her murder began. When Leonard Peltier was arrested for the murder of the two FBI agents at Pine Ridge, the case against him was based on the account of a witness. A Lakota woman, Myrtle Poorbear, claimed she'd seen Peltier commit the murders. She later changed her story, saying that she had been coerced into identifying Peltier as the killer by an FBI agent who had said she might meet the same end as Anna Mae Aquash. Aquash, whose murder had taken place right after Peltier's arrest, had earlier told the FBI she knew nothing about the murders of the agents and would not cooperate with them. Although two senators brought the matter before Congress and the Department of Justice, and although Canadian authorities demanded full accounting for the murder of one of their citizens on the federal land of a friendly neighboring country, the investigation never went far.
Beneath a sky blurred with mist and wind, I am amazed as I watch the violet heads of crocuses erupt from the stiff earth after dying for a season. As I have watched my own dark head appear each morning after entering the next world to come back to this one, amazed. It is the way in the natural world to understand the place the ghost dancers named after the heartbreaking destruction. Anna Mae, everything and nothing changes. You are the shimmering young woman who found her voice when you were warned to be silent or have your body cut away from you. Like an elegant weave. You are the one whose spirit is present in the dappled stars. They prance and lope like colored horses who stay with us through the streets of these steely cities. And I have seen them nuzzling the frozen bodies of tattered drunks on the corner. This morning, when the last star is dimming and the buses grind toward the middle of the city, I know it is 10 years since they buried you. The second time in Lakota, a language that could free you. I heard about it in Oklahoma or New Mexico, how the wind howled and pulled everything down with a righteous anger. It was the women who told me, and we understood wordlessly the right meaning of your murder. I understand 10 years later, after the slow changing of the seasons, that we have just begun to touch the dazzling whirlwind of our anger. We have just begun to perceive the amazed world the ghost dancers enter crazily.
On Thanksgiving Day, many Native Americans and others gather at the top of Coles Hill, overlooking Plymouth Rock, for the National Day of Mourning. The first National Day of Mourning was held in 1970. The event includes Native American speakers, a march through the historic district of Plymouth, and a festive potluck social at a local church.
And I would also like to welcome you to Plymouth Rock. For those who haven't seen it, it's a very small rock down behind this thing here, and you better hurry up because the tide's coming in and it'll probably cover the rock. And we're here to correct a little bit of history, and I'm very briefly going to say something, and I'm going to turn the microphone over to one of the, one of the first people who was at the first National Day of Mourning in 1970. But before I do that, I'd just like to say one thing. This is not where the pilgrims landed. This rock was up in the middle of town in the middle 1800s, and it became a nuisance. And so somebody came up with the bright idea, why don't we move it down here, put 1620 on it, and we'll tell people this is where the pilgrims landed. Now, if they had landed on this rock for real, they would have had to have had the longest legs of any person who ever existed. This is a myth, just as we were talking about myths up on the hill. And it was Malcolm X who said, I believe that we did not land on Plymouth Rock, Plymouth Rock landed on us. And that is the truth. So I'd like to turn the microphone over to Tara, who has a few words of greetings for you.
I want to tell you about the price of friendship. From the very first greedy determined footsteps of the invading Wanooksuk, or strangers on our land, there was one principal intention, to take it for their own by any means possible. Those greedy, calculated intentions have been all too well documented by 384 years of their presence here on our land, which they can never truly own, but will forever be trespasses upon it. This land is made from the dust and bones of our ancestors who cry out with a vengeance to the disrespect of their intrusion and total ingratitude for our willingness to share what the Creator has given us. We did not go to the Wanooksuk. It was the Wanooksuk who came to us to feed off us as some predator or parasite. These pious hypocrites came with the Bible in hand and began the process of taking our land. When they came, they had the Bible, and we had the land. Now we have the Bible, and they have the land. God bless America. With so many of their people having been already eaten by the Spirit Eater, they transplanted here in our land the vulture culture they claimed to have fled from. A culture that fattened itself at the expense of others, based on complete, insatiable greed. A greed that is documented every time I see another real estate or an obscene private property do not enter sign. What is truly real? What is truly real about the estate is that it was ours. Ever since, the Creator put us here and gave us the gift of that land to respect and care for as it continues to contain the dust and bones of our ancestors for all time. They repaid the kindness of Massasoit and our people by killing both of his sons and putting King Philip's head up on a pole here in this town in front of the very same church where they prayed, quote unquote, the bullet through his heart. As a reminder of what would result from any resistance to their terror. God bless America. As these Indian killers evolved into slave traders, they continued to grow fat as we grew lean. as more and more of our dispossessed people, as well as their own, began to clutter up the towns they had built on our graves, they soon began to build poor houses so they could contain the misery and avoid having their eyes and their noses being offended by the sight. Becoming the fuel of the highly profitable slave trade, the New England rum, they could never produce fast enough, served another very important purpose as the Indian exterminator. It still continues as the completely legal drug to finish off the job begun with the torch and the gun, to help clear their title, quote unquote, to our real estate, robbing each Indian family of their fathers or mothers or sisters or brothers, even as I speak. My own father was a victim. God bless America. This insatiable greed for our land that began right here where we stand has never stopped. And my wife and all our future generations became its latest victims on November the 5th in the Massachusetts Land Court, where they fell victim to the economic and judicial terrorism that continues to eat away, vulture style, at whatever lands we may have retained. In spite of the 1665 deed of the original Mashpee Sachems to prevent such a thing, specifically stating it would belong to all future generations, quote, forever, and should never be given or sold or alienated without all their consent, unquote, this separation of Mashpee Indians from their lands took place without burning a single baby alive, or tearing a single child from our arms, or firing a single shot. Through much more perfected and sophisticated methods of executing their greed for our lands, this is all not only possible, but completely, quote, legal, unquote, so we're told. In these times, when we are bringing at the point of a gun freedom and justice to the people of Iraq, the, quote, legal, unquote, system itself has become the preferred weapon of mass destruction that is now used against us to exercise this continuing greed that never seems to die. As long as there remains a single tasty financial morsel on our financial bones to be picked. God bless America. The hierarchy of hypocrisy, which elevated the Pilgrims and the Puritans, America's first terrorists, to the level of some sort of sacred cow, has enabled some Euro-Americans to be so patriotic and venerate to a ridiculous level the flag, which drips with the blood of the native people.
Yeah.
Whose freedom was being denied as their own was proclaimed so loudly at the time of the nativity of that flag. To the Wenoksuk or strangers who came here, the flag is a unifying and essential symbol of the taking of Indian land as their own. Because it serves as the symbol of that adoption, it is venerated all the more by the more recent immigrants to our land, who are programmed to believe the more you wave it, the more American you can become. Especially if you learn to sing God Bless America. To Native Americans who know their history, the flag is the ultimate symbol of true terrorism, as our AIM brothers told us when they first came and buried the flag. We know all too well how the blood of our people was shed from sea to shining sea, as the American dream was constructed at our expense. The broad red stripes that flow from border to border symbolize all the blood of our people that had to flow from border to border as we became the roadkill of the Pilgrim's March of Progress. Singing God Bless America Forever cannot remove the blood from that flag. A prayer offered or sung with denial and hypocrisy should never be expected to be answered. If present-day Americans really want God to truly bless America, there must first be an acknowledgement of all their past wrongs. And a sincere contrition for all that has been and continues to be done to destroy our people and our land. Only then can the much-needed blessing come to America, because there is a great and good creator who looks down and sees all things. The 500 years of denial of the terrorism that was unleashed on this continent by choice of the immigrant terrorists must be acknowledged if the consequences of those wrong choices are to ever cease. Every action has a reaction. From the most respected elder in my family, I learned all of man's problems come from going against the laws of the Creator and of His creation. The hurricanes, tornadoes, and all other natural disasters will continue to break all record-keeping records. Unspeakable horrors worse than 9-1-1 will take place as more and more of the world will come to hate America with even more intensity than they do now. Bombing the babies of Baghdad and slaughtering and crippling innocent Iraqi women and children and their fathers and brothers will not, I say will not, make America safer, but only increase the frustrations and hatred of the witnesses to all these events of collateral damage, quote unquote. The psychological damage to the young U.S. military who may be lucky enough not to come home to their families in a body bag after doing what they have been trained to do is still yet to be determined. Our prophecies have warned about all these things. God bless America. The ancient prophecies have told us that the many strange new diseases for which there is no cure that came from the poisoning of our air and contamination of the sacred waters of life will continue as we approach the period that is called the time of the nine hells coming to an end in the year 2012. The year of the true millennium on the sacred Mayan calendar, which is much more accurate than the European calendar. At this time, the almighty dollar will be worth nothing as the self-destructive value system, of this society reaches its inevitable conclusion. Then, the time of the 13 heavens will begin for the native people of this land, because there is a creator who sees all things. Nieyo, it is so.
A number of years ago, 1997, which I can't believe is 7 years ago, right on this street, right behind us, a number of United American Indians and our supporters were, for lack of a better word, attacked by the officialdom of Plymouth and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And some women and children and elders were pepper sprayed, thrown to the ground brutally. And 25 of us were arrested, and we spent that afternoon, instead of being at a social, we spent it in the brand new, I might add, Plymouth police station, where we were able to negotiate a settlement with the town of Plymouth. Basically, they realized that they were wrong, they had violated our rights, we did not need a permit to march on our own land. And because of that, we were able to negotiate a very nice settlement with the town of Plymouth, and the beautiful thing was is we didn't have to give up a thing, and they had to give up plenty. And the beauty of that settlement, the first part of it was we got a substantial sum of money to start a Native education project, the Metacom Education Project. Another part of that settlement was Plymouth had to erect, at their cost, two historical markers. Now, there was one on Coles Hill, where we started. That explains the National Day of Mourning. And there's one right here behind me. And this talks about Metacom, or King Philip. And this talks about the fact that after he was murdered, his head was displayed on a pole somewhere in this immediate vicinity for 25 years. And if you get a chance to walk by this, take a look at it and read it, because this is actually probably one of only two historical markers in Plymouth that actually tells the truth. We don't talk about, you know, this pilgrim having built this home and so forth and so on. This tells the truth. And this was another part of our settlement. They had to erect this one and the other one down on Coles Hill. But above and beyond all of that, Plymouth basically had to admit that we have the right to hold National Day of Mourning at noon on U.S. Thanksgiving Day and to march through the streets of Plymouth without ever having to get permission from the town of Plymouth. We don't have to get a permit. We don't have to do anything but show up. And guess what? We've shown up, and we're going to continue to show up. I thank everybody who has come this year. I hope to see you next year. And bring a friend. Even though the social hall is small, we'll all get to eat this afternoon. So thank you, and I look forward to seeing you at the 36th National Day of Mourning.
And we also, we want to thank our brothers and sisters, our indigenous sisters and brothers that we never forget, who come from Central and South America. Because we must remember we are one people, and we must remember the prophecy that when the condor and the eagle would be united, then our people would be able to be free.
People from all over come to this gathering. At this 35th National Day of Mourning, a few hundred people turned out, including a man from Peru dressed in traditional clothes of the Incas.
What brings him to the National Day of Mourning here today?
¿Qué le trae a este día de? He's relating that he belongs to a musical folk group called Inca Song. He comes from Peru, and he comes here representing the Incas of Peru, and he's coming on this day of mourning to try to keep the traditions and their beliefs that they have respect for the earth and the sun and
la tierra, dijo la tierra, el sol,
la luna, lo natural,
and the moon,
la naturaleza.
And the moon, all nature.
Could he describe the traditional clothing that he's wearing?
Puede describir la el traje. He's wearing a representation of the dress that the Inca, who was the chief of this big group of natives that cover all the region of Colombia, Peru,
Ecuador,
and Bolivia and Chile.
This year's National Day of Mourning was dedicated to Leonard Peltier.
I know there's a few folks in the crowd who are asking who is Leonard Peltier, and you know what? We should have explained that in the rally, because we shouldn't assume that everybody knows who Leonard Peltier is. Leonard Peltier is an Anishinaabe man. He's a native man who was a member of the American Indian Movement. And he was framed up by the FBI back in 1976. The FBI said that Leonard had shot a couple of FBI agents. They said this and framed him up, even though their own ballistics and other evidence showed that Leonard did not shoot any FBI agents. They wanted somebody to pay for the crime of shooting two FBI agents on Pine Ridge Reservation, even though they know They knew then, and they still know now, that Leonard was not guilty. They insist on keeping him in prison. He has now been in prison for 10,519 days, I believe it is. He has been in prison since his children were young. He now has grandchildren. He is a symbol. Some of you may remember or may have heard of Nelson Mandela, who was a symbol to the world of the fight for justice of the people of South Africa. Leonard Peltier is a symbol to us and to the world of the fight for freedom and justice of the native people.
The entire prison in Leavenworth had been locked down until the day before yesterday. He was unable to communicate with the outside world. But we were fortunate enough to get a statement from Leonard. For the last few years, I have actually hoped that Leonard could be with us on this stage to give a statement. But it just hasn't come to pass. But we will keep fighting for his release. Our leaders follow the principles of truth, faith, and charity, and courage. In essence, this country should practice the principles of Thanksgiving and Christmas throughout the year, as well as the principles of freedom and equality that so many declare is the tradition of this government. So, should Thanksgiving Day of mourning come next year and find me gathering golden oak leaves as a free man, it will be because you didn't give up. Because you stood for the principles I've mentioned, because you demonstrated your commitment to truth, charity, and justice. I swear to you, I will put on a ceremony you will remember and tell your children and grandchildren about. In the spirit of Crazy Horse, your brother forever, Leonard Peltier, Petakius Opresen.
My name is Matawi Monroe. I'm co-leader of United American Indians of New England, and I used to work in Portsmouth years ago and live in Maine. Yeah.
And how long have you been working on organizing the National Day of Mourning?
I think I've been working on organizing it since about 1987, something like that. I don't know. I'm not counting.
And what was it that drove you to start doing that?
I had heard about National Day of Mourning for a number of years, and because I hadn't lived in New England before, had never attended, but when I moved to New England, that was one of the very first things I wanted to do, was to go to National Day of Mourning. And it really, to me, it is such a beautiful day. I love the strength and unity of it. I love all the people who come from, as we say, the four directions, to stand in solidarity with us. I love being outside there at Plymouth Harbor and kind of thinking, just looking out over Plymouth Harbor and thinking about what the world really must have been like before the Europeans invaded and what it must have looked like. I think some people celebrate New Year's Eve. To me, National Day of Mourning is kind of a marker of each year and progress that we've made in the past year, that kind of thing. I love the voices of all the different Native people who come to speak about their struggles or what's on their mind.
I have a question about something that's probably maybe a little more difficult to talk about. As we were walking through town in the march, there was the woman who was yelling out the window. I don't know if you heard her. She kept saying, you know, 200 years, it was 200 years ago. What do you want? What do you want? Things like that. And it's probably something that's heard, you know, fairly often at events like this. What would you say to a person like that?
I actually didn't hear her. I think some people, especially in Plymouth, which makes money off of this mythology and tourism accompanying it. I think some people don't want to part with their mythology, and some people want to believe that, you know, George Washington really didn't chop down, really never did tell a lie, and all of that kind of garbage that they were taught in school, and they want to believe that the Pilgrims were wonderful people and were very fair to the Native people, and they want to believe that Columbus discovered America, and some people are just going to hang on to that kind of dangerous fantasy with every ounce in their body, I suppose. But I think more and more people don't want to hang on to that kind of thing and really do want to know the truth. I think for some people who say, well, that happened hundreds of years ago, what's the problem? Well, you know, we talk about contemporary issues. The problem is that our land, almost all of our land, has been stolen from us. The problem is that not one single treaty has been honored by the United States government. The problem is that Native people continue to live in the deepest poverty in this country and have very little access to decent health care. The problem is that racism against us is so deep and prevalent that people often don't even see it. We're almost invisible in the media. And when I know even, you know, I have young children. I don't even want them to watch a movie like Peter Pan, which many parents take for granted. But Peter Pan has these ugging things that are supposed to be Indians within the movie. And I don't want my children to think that that's what Indians are, because they know better. They know everything about Native people because they're growing up within their culture.
You're one of the main organizers of the National Day of Mourning. Can you talk about how you got involved in it in the first place?
Well, my father, Wamsutta, was one of the founders in 1970. And as he got older, of course, his health wouldn't allow him to keep coming up here to Plymouth and standing outside in the rain and the cold. So in 1994, he and the Council of Elders decided to turn the leadership over to me. And then I immediately turned it into a co-leadership thing with myself and Matoe Monroe, a man and a woman who speak equally, rather than having just one leader, if you will.
And how long have you been involved in the organizing of the event?
Well, this is my 10th year as a leader of the organization, but I had been here in the 70s. I was here the first day of mourning when we boarded the Mayflower and tore the Union Jack down and replaced it with a flag that had flown over Alcatraz. I buried Plymouth Rock 3 or 4 times. So I go way back, but I haven't been here every year, you know, since this began.
I'm sorry, maybe could I get your name and just family background, ancestry?
Well, my name is Munanam, and I'm an Aquina Wampanoag.
I don't know if you noticed this person or not, but as we were marching through town, there was a woman yelling out of her window. And she was saying something about, you know, that was 200 years ago. You know, what do you people want, or something like that? What do you say to a person like that?
Well, basically, we're here to get the truth out. I mean, it may have happened. Actually, it was longer ago than 200 years. She ought to read her history. But we're here to correct the history. I mean, yes, it happened 350 years ago, 385, I think, to be exact. But that doesn't necessarily mean that what happened is correct. And that we should just say, well, it happened, it's over, and it's done with, what can we do? You know, we still have to fight for equality in our own country.
All around the country right now, you know, there are people who are, you know, pigging out on lots of food and not thinking about these things at all. If there was a message that you could send to people who might tune into a show like this, what would you like to say?
Well, I think that what, you know, they should sit down and be grateful and thankful for what they have, but they can't forget that who they had to kill, who they had to murder in order to get that, and who they continue to kill and who they continue to murder in order for them to sit down and enjoy whatever it is they enjoy. It really boils down to that. Do I sound angry? Yes, of course I sound angry. Can I let bygones be bygones? No. I'm going to continue to struggle until I feel that all oppression is ended, until we live in a country where no one goes without, and until we live in a country where the rich don't get richer and the poor get poorer, to where we all have an equal footing. So I guess you could say, basically, until I see the absolute destruction of the system that I presently have to live under.
That actually sort of sparks one more question, if you don't mind. A lot of people make parallels to what, you know, the people who first came here from Western Europe and slaughtered so many Native Americans. And what's happening now in the Middle East, both with, you know, the U.S. invading and occupying Iraq, and also with what's happening to the Palestinians. Many, many people make that parallel that I've heard, that it's very similar. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think what we have to realize is, number one, the Middle East was carved up primarily after World War I. I mean, that's when Kuwait came into existence, and then after World War II, Israel came into existence. And they took Palestine to make Israel. So an indigenous population was totally dispossessed, thrown off their land, said, see you later, we'll put you out someplace where you can't grow anything, you can't do anything. And then Iraq was a sovereign country. It was absolutely no threat to the United States. And one thing I do know that hasn't come out yet is that when they did find weapons of mass destruction over there, but we didn't hear about them finding it because 95% of them said made in the USA. So, I mean, come on. What was the big deal? You know, we're over there, thousands of people have been wounded, maimed, whatever, and then 1,000 or so have been killed for nothing except a little bit of oil. So Bush and his cronies with the Carlyle Group and all these groups can just get richer and richer and richer. And I'm sick and tired of sending our youth over to do that. And especially when, why don't these rich youth go over there? Why don't we ask the president, if you will, or excuse me, the first, I have to put this, appointed president of the United States, you know, why he didn't serve during Vietnam and how come he hid behind his daddy's coattails. So, you know, it's very easy to send somebody else's kid over, and I think it's time that stops.
For Making Waves, I'm Tom Jackson.